Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and Chair of this program. We're delighted to co-host today's program on the health effects of electromagnetic fields with electromagnetichealth.org and Camilla Reese, as well as the Club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and the Science and Technology Forum. On March 19, 2008, we had a similar program organized by Camilla on this topic, at a time when very few people knew there were health hazards from cell phones and wireless technologies. After that program, 110 audience questions were answered by Camilla and Dr. Magda Havas in the book Public Health SOS, The Shadow Side of the Wireless Revolution, and it was sent to every member of Congress and over 100,000 journalists globally. The book is still available through Amazon.com. Since then, the subject is in the media routinely. There have been Senate hearings, and there is congressional legislation that has been announced that will call for a review of the exposure guidelines, funding for EMF research, and warning labels on cell phones. And, of course, those of you in the Bay Area know that San Francisco became the first city to require radiation levels on cell phone packaging and education on radiation risks at the point of sale. As a result, CTIA, the Wireless Industry Association's trade group, announced it is moving its next conference to San Diego after meeting in San Francisco for years. As Gavin Newsom said, San Francisco cannot be bribed or bought. And yesterday, the California Public Utilities Commission pushed for a smart meter health probe. Smart meters, as you know, are installed in homes to relay information about power usage to PG&E via Wi-Fi and send out bursts of radiation that have adverse health effects. So San Francisco is a hotbed of activity on the health effects of EMF, and it's the appropriate place to host this symposium today. Today you will hear from experts from five countries, Canada, England, Norway, Sweden, and the U.S., about the exquisite sensitivity of DNA to electromagnetic fields, the impacts on the heart from the frequency emitted by Wi-Fi and portable phones, little understood connection between everyday electrification and common diseases like heart disease, diabetes, and cancer, a just-published extensive review of the cell tower and infrastructure antenna-related science, and a just-published monograph in Italy on the mechanism of action creating the biological effects. Now, Camilla Reese, who organized today's program, is founder of electromagnetichealth.org, co-author of Cell Phones and Brain Tumors, 15 Reasons for Concern, author of Alzheimer's Moss Study, Do We Smell a Rat?, founder of Campaign for Radiation-Free Schools, and author of the EMF blog, Help blog. She exemplifies the kind of citizen activism we hope to foster in our members on important issues of the day. Now, please join me in welcoming Camilla Reese.
Thank you very much, Bill. Thank you. I am so grateful to be here and have Electromagnetic Health co-organize this program today with the Commonwealth Club, in association with Citizens for Health in Washington, D.C., the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, the EMF Safety Alliance, the Radiation Research Trust in the United Kingdom, and the new and rapidly growing International EMF Alliance, a collaboration of over 50 EMF advocacy groups around the globe, groups from San Francisco to Johannesburg, Sydney to Stockholm, Vermont and Virginia to Spain, Finland, Norway, England, Ireland, countries all around the globe. There is clearly a global response happening, and something is amiss. On every continent in the world, people are questioning the sanity of exposing vulnerable life forms to cell phone and wireless radiation. Paul Hawken, in the film Blessed Unrest, said that the hundreds of thousands of environmental and social justice organizations springing up around the globe on every continent are society's immune response to the world that we have created. The experts you are going to hear on today's program, and many of you in the audience, are a very important subset of that immune response, a critically important subset that some believe is as important to the future of life on this planet as global warming. As you will hear today, artificial electromagnetic fields are unquestionably affecting people's health, relationships, learning capacity, quality of life, length of life, and financial stability. They are disrupting our ecosystem in very serious but little understood ways. And there is grave concern about what blanketing ourselves in these disruptive fields is doing to our genetic material long term. But we are the immune response, and we can change the unconscious trajectory that society is on, disconnected from the natural laws of life, developing technologies, even green technologies in the name of sustainability, without any responsibility for their biological effects, without concern for life. I hope that after today's program, that you will join us in taking a stand for life, for my life, your children's lives, your parents' lives, the life of people all over this globe currently experiencing dysregulation from exposure to telecommunications and utility technologies. From my view, all we need to do for almost any problem in society today is to connect to our most deeply held values and to use our voices to express them, inspiring others to join in and change the world together, to bring the world back to wholeness and integrity, where the whole footprint of our actions is taken into consideration in developing new technologies. Health and harmony and peace are true north. It is there waiting for us to remember and to connect to it, and to stop our addictions to unsafe technologies and to short-term stimuli at the expense of health, relationships, and lives of meaning. Thank you for being with us today. We have a terrific program, and we hope that it is deeply moving for you, not just interesting intellectually, where you learn a lot about the science, but that you grasp the urgent importance of becoming an activated global citizen on this subject, connected to the courage and the power of your conscience. There are four components to today's program. Panel one will be focused on an overview of the history of electromagnetic pollution in our lives. Panel two is focused on the science, where we'll be getting into what do we know about the biological effects on DNA, on cells, on organs, on the body's regulatory systems. In panel three, we'll be focusing on three underappreciated risks: the risk to children in schools, the very little known risk from dirty power, and the risk from the new radiation-emitting smart meters now being installed around the world. But people are resisting on health grounds, but also on for reasons of safety, security, homeland security, fire safety, and on economic grounds. In panel four, we will hear a presentation by Dr. Ole Johansson from the Karolinska Institute recommending new exposure guidelines for global governments. We'll also see a short film of four other experts that will be talking about public policy directions, where do we go from here. And finally, we're very excited to introduce to you a song by a leading Native American singer, Shelley Morningsong, who has created a song for this movement, and we'll be playing that then as well. So thank you, and let me introduce our first panel. Our first speaker is Eileen O'Connor from the Radiation Research Trust in the UK. She was a victim of breast cancer, found herself living near a cell phone tower, and she has become one of the most important activists in Europe, in the United Kingdom and Europe, advising members of the British Parliament and the European Union on this important emerging public health issue, and they're far ahead of us in many ways over there. After Eileen, we have Dr. Ole Johansson, who's one of the leading scientists in the world. He's published over 500 studies and articles on this topic. He's with the Karolinska Institute. And then Dr. Magda Havas, who is with Trent University in Canada. We're happy to have you, and thank you for being here. Eileen?
Thank you for the welcome, and thank you for inviting me to your beautiful city. It's a real honour to be here with you, and thank you to Camilla. I'm Eileen O'Connor from the UK Radiation Research Trust. I'm here to speak about why am I here. I'd suffered for years with sleep problems, headaches, dizzy spells, and vertigo, only to be told by my doctors that it was either stress or a virus. I eventually developed breast cancer at the age of 38, and I discovered that I was living in a cancer cluster. And I understand that we are not alone. And there are many others, many other people living in cancer clusters around phone masts in the UK and throughout the world. I've been living 100 metres from a phone mast, and I now realise that those symptoms that I reported to my doctor are known as a condition called electrosensitivity. The Wishawti mobile phone mast, after 7 years, in 2001, the story began to unfold. I discovered that there were 6 ladies with breast cancer, one prostate cancer, a bladder cancer, a lung cancer, 3 cases of precancer cervical cells, 1 motor neurone disease, people had developed benign lumps, there was electrosensitivity, 3 cases of severe skin rashes, which I was one of those people. Many villagers were suffering with the same radiation sickness symptoms, the sleep problems, the headaches, the dizziness, the low immunity, and many other problems that were being reported. There was even an Olympic standard horse that was suffering with blood problems and was receiving continuous treatment from the vet. In 2003, November, the phone mast was actually forcefully removed, and the village, then the campaign really got going. We fought tooth and nail to make sure that phone mast never returned to our village, and it was a massive media campaign that was well publicised throughout the whole of the UK, and it was on Sky News throughout the world. The phone mast had been there from the early 90s in 1994, so it was one of the early masts of the time. As soon as the mast had been removed, many of the residents had started reporting feelings of well-being, improvement in sleep patterns, people who were even suffering with fertility problems, young ladies, 3 of them became pregnant, and we had increased levels of energy, simple things like the headaches, the dizzy spells, sleep problems, all that disappeared. This is a map of the village, and you can see an image of the mast. And it was just a small village with just 18 houses surrounding that mast. It was estimated that 77% of the residents living in that village had become ill with one form of condition or another. I've since gone from that village campaign to become a member of and working with the Radiation Research Trust in the UK, which is a charity. It was set up in 2003, and this is an image taken outside of the Palace of Westminster where we set up the charity and signed up all our agreement. We're leading supporters of the precautionary approach to electromagnetic radiation. And we've gained charitable status and were supported by members of the UK Parliament and members of the European Parliament from all of the political parties. And we're also indebted to the independent scientific and public health and technical advisors that we receive advice from. From that battle, I'm now the director of the Radiation Research Trust. I'm the founder and board member of the new International EMF Alliance. I'm a member of the UK Health Protection Agency's EMF Discussion Group, and I'm also honoured to be a co-author of the paper Cell Phones and Brain Tumours, 15 Reasons for Concern. We started to work with the media because it was the only way we can really get the message out to the public, which they desperately need to hear. And all of the trustees for the charity have worked closely with the media, and we've had many successful reports. But I'd just chosen one which really had an impact in the UK, which was a TV programme that I actually appeared on. I never imagined that I would actually put myself forward for a reality TV show, but I was desperate to get the message out somehow. So I managed to get through thousands of contestants to become part of the finalists in this programme that was on national television every single night for a week. And it was billed as the political, it was a political programme. It was called Vote For Me. It was billed as the political X Factor. I don't know if you have the X Factor show over here, but it had lots of publicity. And we were all set with challenges of what a Member of Parliament would have to deal with. And I actually went in just on a single issue, which was phone masts. And after every night, the public watched the show and thousands of people phoned up to vote off who they thought should be the least who didn't do as well. And I was actually honoured to reach the final and to get into the final two and came second. And it had a major impact throughout the whole of the UK, just to have that out there every night. But the debate, we've had many debates and many conferences have gone all over the world trying to spread this message. And I've just chosen one which was the most challenging conference that I ever dealt with. And it was the Radiation Research Trust conference in 2008. In order to address all the issues surrounding this debate, we decided to hold a conference at the Royal Society in London, very prestigious venue, similar to what you have here. And it was a major achievement. We decided to bring people from both sides of the debate, from the highest level in the world, from ICNIRP, the World Health Organization, the Russian Committee on Ionizing Radiation Protection, and national bodies such as the UK Health Protection Agency, the MTHR, and they were joined by the independent scientists, politicians, lawyers, and concerned citizens, all offering different viewpoints. And we wanted to discuss risk assessment around this debate. I've just chosen a few of the powerful comments that have come from some of the scientists who were at that event. It was the most challenging, and I can't tell you enough how difficult it was to bring the two sides of this debate together, and that it had never been done before. Here's a quote from Sir William Stewart, and many of you may have be familiar with the Stewart Report, which is famous throughout the world. And Sir William Stewart is the retired chairman for the UK Health Protection Agency. He was the chief scientist, reporting directly to the Conservative and Labour governments. He was Margaret Thatcher's main advisor and also Tony Blair and the main government, you know, for the last over 20-odd years. And this is his quote. Since 2000, there have been a mass of publications, reports, observations and views purporting, to the very least, to implicate phones and base stations as a cause of adverse health effects. At a time of uncertainty, when more information is required, non-peer-reviewed articles should not be ignored. Doing so is ridiculous. They may be right, but unproven, and or offer pointers to be thought about and followed up. Well, I'm ashamed to say they haven't been followed up, and that was in 2000. Other scientists reported children are at risk, and here is another quote. The potential risk to children's health is very high and a completely new problem. The use of mobile phones for those under 18 or pregnant should be restricted. Children have a unique vulnerability as they grow and develop. There are windows of susceptibility, periods when their organs and systems may be particularly sensitive to the effect of certain environmental threats. The existing standards cannot guarantee the safe, healthy development of the next generation. That was from Professor Yuri Grigorev, chairman of the Russian National Committee on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection. And I can't tell you enough how powerfully he gave that quote across. This is just a photograph of all the scientists from both sides of the debate. That was on the terraces of the Palace of Westminster just before we went for dinner. There's other reasons for concern. The International Working Group of Scientists, public health policy professionals produced the Bioinitiative report. I'm sure you're all aware of this, which reported that electromagnetic radiation hundreds of thousands of times below the ICNIRP guidelines is not protecting public health. And that was after a review of over 2,000 scientific research studies. The Ecolog study from T-Mobile, this was actually commissioned by T-Mobile, and it was a review of over 220 peer-reviewed published papers. They found evidence for effects on the central nervous system, cancer-initiating and promoting effects, impairments of certain brain functions, loss of memory and cognitive function, and Ecolog called for the demand of a downgrade of the regulations to the ICNIRP guidelines. That was in the year 2000. There are reports of that here available if anyone wants to speak to Camilla about that. In Europe, the important reflex study was done. This was 12 research groups across 7 European countries, and it cost €3 million. They found that mobile phones can break DNA in human cells, which confirmed findings that were already known in literature by Lion Singh. I found this image really shocking. It was taken from a reflex study. You've got an image of the sham cell before exposure, another image of a cell after 1600 chest x-rays, and you can see the damage of the COMET assay coming off. And then there's a cell that's just had 24 hours exposure to a mobile phone in the current, in this current signal. So that was showing similar damage, which I found terrifying. The World Health Organization actually has a pie chart. And on that pie chart, it shows 80% of published research on FOMAS to date are all showing effects. And this is a paper that was done by a group of scientists that reviewed those papers and have shown, also confirmed those findings, which confirms what we found in our village. Other reasons for concern: we have made progress in Europe. Over 522 members of the European Parliament against just 16 urged ministers across Europe to bring in stricter radiation limits, and they said the limits on exposure to electromagnetic fields which have been set for the general public are obsolete. The European Parliament is greatly concerned with the Bioinitiative report, and it points to its conclusions that the health risks posed by emissions from devices such as mobile phones, UMTS, Wi-Fi, WiMAX, Bluetooth and DECT phones. There are legal decisions that have been taken in the courts. There are just two legal decisions here that I'll leave for you to read, which are also ordering the removal of phone masts. And I'd like to point out, which this is probably similar throughout the world, the UK government are receiving money from the phone industry. They received £22.47 billion in just the auction of the phone licences. The sector brings in about £15 billion in taxes per year. And the government has put just £6 million back into research to date, which represents just 0.04% of the tax revenues from just one single year of operation. This is just totally disproportionate considering the level of health effects. We've tried to get to the root of who is responsible, and is ICNIRP responsible? That was the question. Paolo Vecci, the chairman from ICNIRP, presented at the Radiation Research Trust conference in 2008. In his presentation, he made it very clear that the ICNIRP guidelines are neither mandatory prescriptions for safety, the last word on the issue, nor are they defensive walls for industry or others. This statement makes it clear that the decision to adopt guidelines into national legislation as sufficient to protect public health is political. It's the government's misuse of ICNIRP that is the primary issue here. The Radiation Research Trust are about to launch on a new campaign. We're really concerned about the research that's coming out about fertility to men. And we're about to launch the Save the Males campaign. And we have this poster that's been designed. So the future is in your hands. This is going to go in the male toilets in London. And it's showing that medical experts are warning people, men especially, to keep the phones out of the pockets, as it can have an impact on your fertility. And that's just how it's going to look when the men approach the toilets. We hope it should have an impact. But thank you for listening. Thank you to Camilla. And I've just got one final quote. Science is about ensuring facts and evidence are never twisted or obscured by politics or ideology. It's about listening to what our scientists have to say, even when it's inconvenient, especially when it's inconvenient. And that's Barack Obama, your president. This is my quote. For the sake of us all, especially our children, non-ionizing radiation is a high priority for public health. Leaders from all continents should come together to address this unfolding tragedy to humans, animals, and nature. And I hope and pray that Obama listens to his own words and takes action. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to save questions after each panel. We're going to have 10 minutes for questions and a 10-minute break. And we're going to go right now into a presentation by Dr. Ole Johansson of the Karolinska Institute. We will not focus on lengthy bios because you have them in front of you. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for inviting me here. The generosity with which I've been met makes me feel that this is actually going to be the second summer of love. I work at the Karolinska Institute, which, you know, is famous for its Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. I also uphold the position at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, which is connected to the similar prizes in chemistry and physics. The history of electromagnetic fields and electricity in general, of course, goes more than 4,500 years back, because people for a long, long time ago in ancient Egypt referred to these electric eels as thunder of the Nile, and they were aware of the shocks they could get. Ancient cultures around the Mediterranean knew that objects such as rods of amber could be rubbed with cat's fur to attract light objects like feathers. If you instead rub the cat's fur, it will attract kind people, of course. Benjamin Franklin, which is on your $100 bills, in 1752, is reputed to have shown that lightning was indeed electrical in nature. If we jump to the end of the 1900th century in Sweden, already then, when the new electricity was introduced on a larger scale, certain persons actually started to claim adverse health effects. There are a number of anecdotal reports that early found indications of presence of what we today would call electrohypersensitivity. And this was further strengthened by the introduction of amateur DX radio and similar technologies like in the 40s and 50s. One of the very first and very important scientific studies to attract serious health interest came in 1971 following the work of epidemiologist Nancy Wertheimer and physicist Ed Leeper that studied childhood leukemia and its connection to electromagnetic fields. Of course, persons like Henry Lai, which is one of the real experts, also very early studied single and double drain strand DNA breaks in rat brain cells after exposure to 2.45 gigahertz fields and found such serious strand breaks. And they are very serious because they could lead to a lot of dramatic following effects, including brain cancer. And I remember June 4, 1996, when I walked home, I saw this flyer in Stockholm, which I tore down, and it says that scientists are sounding the alarm, mobile phones can give brain damage. Already then, I was very well aware of that something was fishy when it came to the public exposure using electromagnetic fields of various man-made sources. And the year before, I had written an article in the main tabloid in Sweden, Aftonbladet, and I asked how dangerous are actually mobile phones and similar technologies. And I posed some very simple and straightforward questions, and unfortunately, I must say, more than 15 years later on, they are still unanswered. And at least in Sweden, as in the UK, there is basically very, very little money put into research. And unfortunately, most of the money goes to what I would call seriously dependent scientists. A long time before that, 1983 actually, I coined an expression that has been used and cited widely by many other scientists. And I asked myself and others, this is the largest full-scale experiment ever. What happens when we, 24 hours around the clock, wherever we are, allow ourselves and our children to be used as guinea pigs, whole body irradiated for the rest of our lives? And I've been asking this question over and over and over and over again. And believe me, I'm tired. I'm going on like this year after year, and I don't get the necessary answers. I've asked, for instance, the Swedish government and parliament, who has rolled out all these techniques in Sweden for their documentation, clearly showing that this is without risk. So far, I have not received a single sentence. Nothing has come back. was in other countries like Norway, as well as in Sweden and many, many other countries, people feel, and this is an example from Norway with a member of the parliament, that their health authorities, and in this particular case, the Norwegian Radiation Protection Board, they are not doing their job. They are protecting the radiation, but not the people. And therefore, in Norway, and you have the founder in front of you, Sissel Halmøy, they have founded the People's Radiation Protection Board. And that's not good. In democracies like Norway, Sweden, United States, and so on, when people don't longer have trust in their authorities, something is not good. It shouldn't be like that, you know. We have elected and paid for to feel safe and to use safe things and methods and techniques and whatever. We shouldn't do their job. They get, at least in Sweden, hell of a payment. So that's strange. In Sweden, electrohypersensitivity is officially recognized functional impairment since the year 2000. At the same year, the Nordic Council of Ministers also classified its symptoms as an occupationally related symptom-based diagnosis, being part of the International Diagnosis Code System, ICD-10. So in Sweden, it's at least somewhat easier to be electrohypersensitive. 2006, we had a very important meeting in Italy in Benevento, and Eileen O'Connor, for instance, was there and many other people. And at this meeting where we discussed the precautionary approach to these issues, we also documented and published a resolution. And the first bullet point says that more evidence has accumulated suggesting that there are adverse health effects from occupational and public exposures to various electromagnetic fields at current exposure levels. What is needed but not yet realized is a comprehensive, independent, and transparent examination of the evidence pointing to this emerging potential public health issue. And we thought that governments and parliaments and health authorities should do this compilation. They should take all the scientific data and publications and put them together, but they didn't do nothing. So we had to do the job ourselves. And here is from the Karolinska Institute a picture of me and Cindy Sage, and we were two of the more than 15 scientists and experts that wrote the Bioinitiative report. It was published August 31st, 2007. And it's a short report. We only made it up to about 600 pages, summarizing 2,000 publications. But already then, there was a lot more. But we didn't have any money. We had no support. We had nothing, not even a pencil. We had to work in evenings and weekends and so on. And had we had all the necessary resources, the Bioinitiative report would have been much, much, much thicker. And also, the day after its formal publication, September 1st, 2007, I had in my computer already three new publications that should have been included. And I could go on for weeks, actually, to discuss the details in the Bioinitiative report. I don't have the time, but next time I come back, I will lecture for 3 or 4 weeks, and I will give you all the data, because there's so much to be learned from it, you know. And to summarize, it does not speak in favor of this full-scale human experiment. Not at all, you know. After it, there has been a tremendous number. You know, when I come back to my computer, every morning it looks like a pregnant woman, because it's filled with new publications, new data, new reports, new books, new articles, whatever. And it's an explosion of knowledge, really. And I will just give you 3 or 4 examples, which has been mentioned already. Effects on male fertility, male sperm cells, dramatic effects, to be honest, you know. Exposure of pregnant women to mobile phones significantly increased fetal and neonatal heart rate and significantly decreased the cardiac output. When I ask fathers and mothers if they think this is good, no one says, yes, this is good for my baby. Effects on survival rates, also dramatic such. This is from a doctoral dissertation in Belgium by Dirk Agan. And finally, one of the maybe most important papers, namely studies on tomato plants and damaging effects by microwave exposure. And I could quote the scientist who said it was as we had knocked the tomato plants with a hammer. And they had just exposed it to 900 megahertz GSM mobile telephony. 2009, in the journal Pathophysiology, we published a special issue, a very good such, and Martin Blank here was heading this work and did a beautiful job, I must say. And again, there was a resolution published, a two-page resolution, and we said that based on the precautionary principle, children and vulnerable groups such as people with epilepsy and heart conditions should not be exposed to risk of harm. Thus, we proposed that children under 16 should use mobile phones and cordless phones for emergency calls only. No Wi-Fi, WiMAX, or other forms of wireless networking are placed in homes, schools, or public areas or promoted for use thereof. Important. Eileen mentioned a very important thing, and it came really as a surprise because, to be honest, when you write 600 pages in a binary report, you don't think anyone should really read it or cite it or whatever. But it turned out that the European Parliament had read it very carefully. And based on it, they concluded that the limits on exposure to electromagnetic fields, which have been set for the general public, are obsolete. And they included all forms of wireless technologies. Anything was included in their conclusion. And that was, of course, a big surprise to us September 4, 2008. And based on it, we went last year in November to Norway and sat down with an expert group and started to read and think and discuss and summarize, and with the single aim to come up with new biologically based exposure guidelines. And that I will tell you in the next part. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ole Johansson. Our next speaker is going to be Dr. Magda Havas from Trent University.
Thank you very much. I'm here to talk about the history of the research on the health effects of microwave radiation. In April of this year, a friend of mine sent me this document, which is a bibliography of the studies looking at the biological and clinical effects of microwave radiation. It was produced by the Naval Medical Research Institute, and it came out in 1971. It was written by Dr. Zori Glazier. In this document, there are over 2,000 references to the health effects of both thermal and non-thermal microwave radiation. I was amazed as I started going through it and looking at what the studies were reporting on. Heating, which we know about, physiological function, effects to the nervous system, psychological disorders, blood disorders, vascular disorders, biochemical changes, and you can read the rest of them here. I was so amazed when I saw this list, especially since it had been produced in 1971, because these symptoms are the same symptoms we currently call electrohypersensitivity. And while this research came out more than 40 years ago, it's based on research that's between 10 and 20 years old. So for the last 60 years, scientists have been documenting the adverse effects of microwave radiation, and very few of those references were available to the general public. I was so impressed with this document, and I wanted to know if Dr. Zori Glazier was still alive, because I wanted to phone him and thank him for his amazing contribution. And I looked him up on Google, found him right away, called him, and within 2 days he called me back, and we had a delightful conversation. And he said, you know, we have much more than 2,000 publications. After he worked for the U.S. Navy, he worked for the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and he worked for the Food and Drug Administration. So he was a military man and a government man. And they were so impressed with his original research on microwaves that they asked him to continue to supplement the research. And so for the next 15, 20 years, that's exactly what he did. And he said his most recent supplement had over 6,000 documents looking at the health and biological effects of this radiation. We had a delightful conversation. At the end of it, I asked him, by any chance, do you happen to have the hard copies? And he said, funny, you should ask. He's retired now. He's in his late 70s. And he said, they're in storage. I've kept absolutely everything. And he said, I offered them to universities across the United States and to libraries, and no one wanted them. And he said, as a matter of fact, I was thinking of throwing them all out. Well, I was amazed. And before I knew what I was saying, I said to him, could I have them? He thought for a minute, and he said yes. I went down. He lives in Maryland. I was giving a talk at Johns Hopkins University. At the end of that month, I went down, visited him, went to a storage unit. There were a huge number of boxes there. We decided that I would come back a month and a half later. A friend and I flew down. We hired a truck, and we loaded the truck with over 30 boxes of an amazing resource base that we were able to get across the Canadian border. I was really quite concerned because a lot of them were military documents that were all declassified, but I was still concerned that they might not allow us to go through it. These are some of the documents. They come from the U.S. Department of Navy, NASA, the U.S. Congress. He also had limited copies. This is a copy. 5 out of 15 copies were made. It was written by a medical doctor who was reporting that the current guidelines they had in 1967 for microwave exposure were far too high, and that the U.S. government should consider lowering them to get closer to the Russian guidelines or the guidelines in the former Soviet Union. There were a number of foreign translations in this collection, mostly Russian, but also from Czechoslovakia, Poland. It was just an absolutely amazing resource, and it also had current peer-reviewed publications. And I can't begin to tell you what a wealth of resources that we have here. What we decided to do is to scan all of these documents, but I haven't read them all. I've gone through them once in a very cursory way. We've selected about 200 or 300 that we're going to scan right away, and these are some of the things that I'm learning from his studies. The research explains the harmful non-thermal effects have been known by the 1950s. The research actually started in the 1920s and 1930s, before we had radar. The Russian research was started from the perspective of healing, using electromagnetic frequencies to heal. The guidelines they have in Russia right now are 10 microwatts per centimeter squared. The American research in this started with military radar to make sure that the levels were sufficiently low to protect radar operators. Their first recommended guideline was 100,000 microwatts per centimeter squared. They very quickly ended up reducing that because the internal scientists and medical doctors were saying, you really screwed up on that particular measurement. It's come down from 100,000, that took a few weeks because it was obviously very wrong, to 10,000, which lasted for a number of years. And the current guidelines you have here in the United States and that we also have in Canada are 1,000 microwatts per centimeter squared. They're much, much higher than the Russian guidelines of 10 microwatts per centimeter squared. We're in the process of scanning all of these documents, and until we have them all scanned, I'm putting them on my website, which is www.magdahavis.com. We've labeled them from Zori's archives, and Dr. Glazier also has a website, so you can learn more about the research that he's done. This is an amazing wealth of information. I'm so delighted that he made it available to us, and we want to make it available to everyone. It's not only on my website, it's going to be on websites around the world, and it's going to be free of charge to anyone who wants them. Thank you very much.
Do you want to take the video now or not? I'll put it in. Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Havas. Now we're going to watch a short film to end this section. It's on the environmental effects, the little known environmental effects, what's happening in nature to birds, bees, bats. And we'll be featuring a short film with Starling Childs, who's adjunct faculty at Yale University. He grew up with a 6,000-acre forest that he inherited, and so he's been lived very, very close to the land. He's a geologist and forestry consultant, and I'm so happy that we could share this with you because a lot of focus is on the human health impacts, but as you're going to hear, the effects on nature are just as serious. So I'll just begin. And while we're waiting, everyone, if you could send up your questions to the front. We will have Q&A afterwards.
We've known, certainly, that electromagnetic fields have affected trees. We've gone on the studies in Spain by Dr. Alphonse Balmori in the last few decades, where he's been looking at the effect on storks or on house sparrows, you know, these birds that enjoy sharing the urban environment with us and have been perfectly capable of doing that over centuries and eons, are now showing great declines in the number of bird species. There's even studies on the migration of birds that show that birds have a naturally occurring, as all life does, amount of magnetite that allows them to sort of follow the ley lines of the earth. The geomagnetic field of the earth is how they migrate over great distances, and that these unnatural fields are in fact deflecting them off of their migratory patterns, their migratory routes, and in some cases drawing them right into the towers, which leads in many cases to bird strikes and bird deaths when they hit the guy wires of the very large telecommunications towers. Frogs, recent studies done by Alphonse Balmori in Valladolid, Spain, where he put Faraday cages over one tank of tadpoles or eggs, in this case frog eggs, within 140 meters of an antenna, and then left the other tank with the frog eggs out fully exposed to electromagnetic fields. And as the eggs hatched, he watched the development of the tadpoles, and the ones that were protected by the Faraday cage showed completely normal development. The ones that were out in the open, exposed to electromagnetic fields, showed poor form development. Some actually outright died, and others just never really got up to the actual energy and speed that the other tadpoles develops. But what we're seeing is that there's some effect, clearly, on all sorts of biota, and in this case, the fauna of the earth, that are probably sentinel species. They're the species that are trying to tell us something about the environment that we're choosing to live in. And then finally, we're questioning things like the collapse of the bee colonies all over the world. I mean, it's significant, it's global, and it spells great threat for our human species in terms of losing the pollinators. If we lose the pollinators, then game over. We won't be able to feed the planet. Ulrich Warnke in Germany, a very interesting study where he actually exposed several hives to electromagnetic fields, not high electromagnetic fields, but within the range of the gigahertz that the normal cordless telephone, the standard household cordless phone. He just put the cordless phone base stations right next to those hives, took the control hives unexposed, and then took the bees from those hives 800 meters away with little tags, if you can imagine, marking the bees, and then let them out. And the ones in the exposed hives, some of them made it back within an hour or 2 hours, but, you know, 30-40% never even returned to those hives. And then the control bees, the unexposed bees, were all back within 30 minutes. But it's clear to me that bees, which, again, operate within the natural background field of electromagnetic energy that the earth produces, and that actually locate their food sources and their hives and communicate that to the rest of the bees in the hive. They come back and do the dance and say, here's where we go to find the pollen, and then off they go following a natural ley line. These are being confused and completely cross-modulated. And then finally, I'm concerned about bats. I'm concerned about bats, moths, other insects like that, and certainly bats that are controlling a lot of our pest insects, mosquitoes, you name it. They eat 80% of their body weight every night in insects. Bats are crashing all over our country and again in Europe as well. And what it is it's, again, a blight, a fungus. That's all we can say. It's a white nose fungus. It's white nose syndrome. But literally millions of bats have disappeared in the last 5 years as we switch on more and more of these towers on hillsides and completely energize the actual air sphere in which they have to live. That's where they conduct their own electromagnetic pulses, their sonar, if you will, to find their prey. Why this isn't a greater concern to our country as a whole, and certainly I notice in the researchers in Europe and elsewhere are really looking at these questions. Al Manville, who I spoke of at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, who's in charge of the migratory bird monitoring, has shown great concern and has asked time and time again that even the communications companies themselves should at least be funding this research. And if, in fact, what he's seeing and what he believes is the case, then it's time to really question the sanity of then further rolling out additional electromagnetic fields and starting to think about, do we need the amount of energy in our environment that we already have, or can we make do with less, more appropriately sited, and more intelligently deployed? It's an emerging field of science, but it's one that's critically important, or we're gonna have a silent spring that Rachel Carson never could have imagined, and that's serious.
Okay, great. So we have a lot of questions.
We've known certainly that electromagnetic.
Well, we should probably listen to it again. Yes. Okay. So we have a lot of questions, and just looking through them, they fall into three categories: questions about the health, questions about smart meters, and questions about what can we do as citizens. So I'd like to focus the Q&A in the first program on the health questions. Libby Kelly will be doing a program on the third panel on smart meters, and we'll take the questions for that after that one. And then we have a program at the end focus on what next, public policy directions. So we will also, any questions that we don't get to, we will try to divvy them up and do what we did last time, which was put together an answer to everybody's questions. So the first question is, could an increase in Asperger's autism be caused by electromagnetic radiation? So, Oli, Dr. Johansson, would you like to answer that question? Could there be a connection between electromagnetic radiation and Asperger's autism and diseases of those kinds?
There is no knowledge about that, so anything is possible, of course, but...
Okay. So what is your opinion as to the effects of 900 megahertz frequency versus the tetra frequencies, 400 to 500 range? Is one more lethal to humans than the other?
The tetra frequency seems to be a lot more harmful based on the studies that have been done, and I think it's based on the pulsing of that particular system that's used in the UK primarily.
Now, I know personally a doctor whose brother, who was a police officer in the UK, who died of esophagus cancer, and he was age 38. He pleaded with his brother, who's a radiation expert, to make sure he gets this message out to the public and that his death wouldn't be in vain. And there are reports of other officers who are suffering at the moment.
Okay. Just a minute. Knowing I've been seriously exposed to radio frequencies, how do I find a medical doctor who knows how to treat these symptoms, especially metallic taste, loss of hair, brittle nails, interrupted sleep?
There are a growing number of doctors around the world and a growing number here in North America who are becoming aware of electrosensitivity. We can certainly provide you with names of them. We have one that I know of in this room, Dr. Jeff Maringel, who's at the back, who's got a lot of experience now with electrical sensitivity. And I suspect that if you contacted Dr. Burton Goldberg, he would be able to guide you to people, doctors who are familiar with this and have had success in treating people. And Burton's here as well in the front row.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Johansson, you want to comment?
Yeah, I always tell people, at least in Sweden, when they want to go to a doctor, that take the symptoms and go to the doctor and see what he or she can do. But don't mention anything else, because even in Sweden there are a number of physicians that would object to the idea that there could be an electron hypersensitivity. So start just with the symptoms and have them treated.
Can I add, when I had my breast cancer, I raised this with my oncologist and breast cancer surgeon, and they didn't believe it at first, and then they started seeing loads of other ladies being diagnosed with breast cancer. And I just started bombarding them with the research. I think that's what we need to do. We need to help to educate the doctors, because they're not getting the information from the government. And eventually they set up a meeting with a small group of scientists, and then they supplied me with a letter saying they realised that microwaves do cause cell damage, and that they supported me to the highest level to get independent research carried out. So I'd recommend you really try and help your doctors to do the same.
Yeah, that's a very good point, I must say. I agree to that. And also, like in Sweden, when it comes to electrohypersensitivity, as I said in my lecture, of course, the person with electrohypersensitivity is not a patient. He or she is not going to be treated. It's the environment that is treated in Sweden by shielding, distance, and so on.
I'd just like to add one more point. The things that I mentioned to people who are electrically sensitive, they have to do three things. One is they have to clean up their environment, as Dr. Johansson has just stated. The other thing they have to do is they have to build up their immune system, because their immune system is totally depleted and overworked. And the third thing they have to do is detox. And the manner in which those three are done, I think, should be done under the expertise of someone who really understands this field.
Can I just add as well, in January this year, we brought Professor Oleg Grigorev across to the UK. He's second in command at the Russian National Committee on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, also works with the health, national health there. It's not even a debate anymore in Russia. They're actually building labs in their hospitals to bring in patients who are electrosensitive. They're going to allow them to detox. They're going to monitor their health as they detox, and then they'll take them into specialist rooms and expose them to the frequencies, whole range of different frequencies, because it's such a complicated condition. Some people may be sensitive to one frequency but are not another. They may be sensitive to a certain level but not another. And then the Russians believe that they can then treat the patient. Mm-hmm. So we need to really be working with the Russians, and they're ready to engage with anybody who's willing to listen.
This is a similar question. What simple tests can be devised for health practitioners to test their patients' level of EMF sensitivity? Magda?
Well, this is something that we're working on currently. We find that if you're a diabetic and you're electrically sensitive, then chances are your blood sugar is going to respond to this. So if you're exposed to high levels of radiation or dirty power, your blood sugar will increase. And if you reduce your exposure, your blood sugar will decrease. We've worked with people looking at the effects on their nervous system, and so looking at heart rate variability is another technique we've started testing, and I'll talk about that later on today. The third test that seems to also work is looking at live blood cells and looking at whether or not you have rouleau formation, which is a clumping of the blood cells. That happens very quickly after exposure for someone who's electrically sensitive, and we're hoping to come up with other types of diagnostics as well.
Mm-hmm. I've been experiencing ringing in my ears with increasing volume for the past 2 years. We took a short 10-day vacation in the mountains, and on the seventh day, the ringing stopped. The ringing recommenced after 3 days on our return. Does this mesh with what you know about electromagnetic fields?
I could answer that, at least partly. We did a small study in Sweden where we collected electrohypersensitive people and asked them to give us all their symptoms, and it turned out that the only symptom that all the electrohypersensitive people had was tinnitus or ringing in the ears. So that sounds very plausible indeed, yes.
Mm-hmm. To Ole Johansson, have you done any work on the downstream effect of cytokine activation from EMR, such as Th17, IL-6, or IL-17?
That's a very interesting question. I wish I could say yes, but the problem in Sweden is that until very recently, we have had no money for many, many years. So actually, as a scientist, I have had to do completely other things in areas that are, of course, very important too. But to study health effects of electromagnetic fields in Sweden, it's very, very hard if you are not connected to the industry or something similar. So unfortunately, we would love to do studies exactly along these lines. And I think, as Magda pointed out also, this tear down or wear down of the immune system is extremely important. And I did recently a summary for the journal Pathophysiology. It was very interesting because electromagnetic fields, particularly microwaves, seem to initially stimulate the immune system, but very soon it deteriorates, and it deteriorates very rapidly and dramatically. So that would be a key issue to address, and I hope you here in United States, because I see you have a lot more money, I watched around in San Francisco, you know, and you can do all these experiments. And then you are invited to come to Stockholm to receive the Nobel Prize.
Okay, so, and while you're on the way to Stockholm, they want to know, what about the airport scanners? How much radiation are we getting? And
well, I think Eileen should address that issue, but I would just say that I found your story yesterday so very interesting and stimulating, and that's actually what I have always said to people, at least in Sweden. I can only really talk about that. People are they're not used to say no.
I was actually horrified when I got to the airport and coming here, and I was asked to go through one of the scanners. And everybody was going through them willingly. And some of them were asked to go in a second time because it hadn't quite got the image. And you could actually see the monitor, the screen of everybody's. You can see it was just so graphic of everybody coming through. Everybody in the room waiting could see. I felt really sorry for one poor lady who came through with a group of friends. And you could actually see she had silicone implants and she was so embarrassed and it was awful for her. And but I actually refused point blank and said, there's no way I'm going through that scanner. And I thought they weren't going to allow me on the plane, but I stood my ground and I just said, I've had breast cancer. I've had so many scans. There's no way you're getting through me and through one of those. And for that reason, you know, you're going to have to do whatever it takes, and I'm not going through. And the lady said, it's no more exposure than if you were having an ultrasound scan if you were pregnant. And, you know, I just said, I'm sorry, I'm not doing it. And so they then, a man behind me, refused to go through it as well. I was told to go to the back of the queue, and I started to get out the latest news report where American scientists were saying that they were concerned. And then I was, they allowed me to go through quietly, I think, because the queue was building up behind me.
I think this story is extremely important because I've urged for decades, you know, that people should just stand up for their rights and just say no. And also, I just add to that story, when I passed the customs border here, you know, at least as, again, a Swede, you're always afraid, you know, these officers, they look so grim at you, you know, and you feel that you probably carry 100 tons of heroin or something, just by mistake, you know. And he asked me what I was going to do in the United States, and I told him explicit in detail, and he was extremely interested, and particularly because he had all these hand and thumb and finger scans and cameras, computers and whatever, and I said, you sit in a real cocktail of electromagnetic fields. And he said, yeah, I slowly realized that, you know.
In Canada, Air Canada, the airline, the people who work for Air Canada are very concerned about this, and they're represented by the Canadian Auto Workers Union. They're just doing a study now. They're initiating one to find out what the workers are exposed to, and I assume that they're going to be looking at these scans. These scans use a very high frequency, which is supposed to penetrate the body just a few millimeters. If any of you have to go through them for whatever reason, it's really important to keep your eyes closed because your eyes are one of the most sensitive parts of your body, and at least you can have your eyelids closed, that should protect your eyes.
Can you please address the military investment in microwave weapons, Lockheed, Martin, etc., and how this alliance with industry is obstructing public awareness of the microwave health effects?
Meg,
I missed that question. Sorry.
Oh, okay. No. Can you please address the military investment in microwave weapons and how this alliance with industry is obstructing public awareness of microwave health effects?
Well, it's really interesting because if you look at the research that's funded by the military or by industry, their results are totally the inverse of what independently funded science is. In the military, they're using very high frequencies, and I think it's 80 gigahertz. I'm not 100% certain. I might have that number wrong, as a way of crowd control. And they've tested it on their own soldiers wearing different amounts of clothing from winter gear, very thick gear. The pain is excruciating when you're exposed to it. It's absolutely excruciating. And so this is what some of the research is actually focused on, how to control crowds using very high-frequency microwave radiation.
Okay, since we have no senses to alert us to the dangers of EMF except those of us who have become electrosensitive, it is hard to get people, especially the parents of my grandchild, to get them to know that EMF, cell phones, Wi-Fi, et cetera, is actually harmful. For busy people who will not look into this themselves, what is the best approach you have found to get people, especially parents, to stop using cell phones, laptop computers, Wi-Fi next to their children? Dr. Johansson.
I think one very good way is to do what you do today, to get together and collect information and inform people. And I always say you shouldn't trust me or we up here. You should gather your own piece of information, think, discuss, meet, and come down with an answer. And maybe you should sort of pick every household item you have and every situation, working situation and so on, and ask yourself, do I really need to have an electric toothbrush? Do my kid have to sit in front of the television many hours every day and so on? And made an informed decision.
So what is the cell phone industry covering up the real dangers of electromagnetic fields, and how would you compare today's crisis to the tobacco industry?
Well, I'd like to just go back to that Ecolog report. I was absolutely horrified to find that it was from 2000 and T-Mobile had actually paid for that report, and it was held in the German language. It was leaked to activists in the UK, and it took the activists in the UK to have it translated and then to expose it. And I'd really recommend that you get a copy of it from Camilla, and it just points out, well, why didn't they make it publicly available? You know, why didn't they take action when they were told to downgrade the guidelines at that time? You know, they just done nothing about it at all.
I have a few copies of that report. It's also posted on electromagnetichealth.org, and we sent it to all the Bay Area media this week. It's a great summary of exactly what's known, commissioned by the industry itself. We'll have one more question, which is about test gear for how do we assess our exposure to electromagnetic fields.
I've got a great little meter with me here. I'm willing to show anybody. You can actually, because some of the spectrum analyzers are so complicated to use, and it's a great awareness tool, you know, if you want to educate your friends, your family, everybody that the dangers are real, because you can't hear it, see it, smell it, feel it. But this radiation detector turns it into sound, and you can actually see the levels of radiation as well that are in your homes. And once you hear the sound of radiation, it is frightening.
Okay, great. It's 1:12 according to Dr. Havas's watch. We'll have a 10-minute break. Be back here promptly, please, in 10 minutes at 22 after. We need to stay on schedule. In fact, we actually need to leave the building at 4:30, so we're on a very rigid schedule.